Just after 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and that must mean it's time again for Money Management with Opus 111 Group's Mike Mayo. Here's Mike.
Hi, good morning. This is Money Management. My name is Mike Mayo. I'm with the Opus 111 Group, and we're here to talk with you about the financial news, a recap on what's been going on in the economic world, and most importantly, how it all affects you. We are your antidote to conventional wisdom. Now, I want to give you the data dump here, how all the indices closed this week. But first, just kind of a preview of coming attractions. We'll be talking about what the Fed announced this week, some of the economic developments like the impact of the UAW strike and the potential government shutdown on the markets. We'll be looking at a couple thoughts on inflation and then, of course, comments on the marketplace in general. Now, the Dow closed the week at 33,963. S&P ended at 43,020. The NASDAQ at 13,611. Russell 2000 finished at 1,777. The gold price settled at $1,945 an ounce. Silver was at $23.54 an ounce. We had the crude price at $90.03 a barrel. That was off its earlier highs this week. We've got, the 10-year was at 4.43%, and soft white wheat quoted at $6.86 a bushel. Now, I found a piece from Ben Graham. He was Mr. Buffett's mentor, and he had a quote which I thought was particularly appropriate for this, the way this week has been. He said, and I'm quoting, "Investing isn't about beating others at their game. It's about controlling yourself at your own game." And I think that's been pretty necessary here in this last couple weeks or so. You know, historically, stocks do very well after the midterm elections, and that's exactly what happened. And then here into the third quarter, the struggle begins for a few months. The matter of fact, the stock market has now entered its worst 10-day stretch of the year, historically speaking. The Carson Group found that when the S&P index performance had been averaged back to 1950, a rocky market patch has typically been seen between the 20th and 30th of September. Of those 11 days, only two, the 27th and 28th, have been positive on average. So, big party next Wednesday and Thursday. Every other day, just plan on not paying any attention. Even further, if we go back to 1928, the median S&P return for the last 10 of 11 days in September has been negative. So, what we've been seeing so far this year is exactly a perfectly normal market. So, let's start with that as a theorem and kind of go from there. So let's start with the Fed. Boy, did they cause all kind of trouble this week, those dirty guys. Let's see. They began lifting interest rates from near zero back in March of 2022, and they pretty much decided to hold them steady in a range between 5.25 and 5.5 this past week. Now, one more rate hike is anticipated by the majority of policymakers before the end of the year. And that's just that they had forecasted back in June. And they still do expect to have one more hike before the end of the year and fewer cuts than previously indicated next year. The committee in their announcement on Wednesday also said economic activity is, quote, expanding at a solid pace, unquote, compared to moderate in previous statements. It also noted that job gains have, quote, slowed in recent months but remain strong, unquote. So, with economic activity stronger than anticipated, most of the officials, Fed officials, also expected that rates will then need to remain higher for longer. And that's what's been messing up the traders. What's longer? I don't know. What's higher? They don't know either. So, we get markets going sideways because they can't decide which way to go. Now, the Fed, I think, is afraid of ending rate hikes only to discover it down the road here that they didn't go far enough. And it could be particularly problematic if the markets conclude that inflation and interest rates had flattened out, only to learn it was the opposite. Well, because it can take a year longer for rate increases to actually slow economic activity, Mr. Powell has said gradual rates would give the officials more time to assess the effect. Now, they will meet again on October 31st and November 1st, and then again in early to mid-December. The rate increases, in effect, do much of the work that the Fed rate increase would be intended to achieve by further reducing demand for rate-sensitive purchases, such as houses and cars. So that helps take some of the pressure off. Now, during the press conference on Wednesday, questions revolved around how will they determine, the Fed, when as if rates have become sufficiently restrictive and they don't have to raise rates anymore? Well, Mr. Powell kind of tap-danced around that. He said that he will know it when he sees it. That's a solid nothing. Okay, so, but in other words, the Fed doesn't have a high degree of confidence on when exactly the rate hike cut process will be accomplished. They have had a very difficult time forecasting how inflation and rates would unfold, and their models still aren't up to the job. Well, shoot, they started from a position that was totally unlike anything else, so that unto itself is not particularly surprising. Now, it does remain to see how quickly these reductions we're seeing in the money supply are going to translate into inflation getting back to the Fed's 2% target, but the Fed has gained some traction in this inflation issue. Now, going forward, in these next couple meetings and thereafter, each of those should be considered what's called active, meaning that they can be ready to raise rates further if their data suggests more work has to be done. And they do like their data. So without a clear path forward due to the potential government shutdown, slowing economic growth, and higher oil prices, it could cloud their vision, but we'll see. So where's the finish line? I don't know. Nobody else knows for sure, so stay tuned. Now, a couple of comments on the economy here. The following is my opinion, but I think it's pretty dang true. Otherwise, it wouldn't be my opinion, would it? Anyhow, the only thing that is disturbing the economy this time around is that short-term interest rates are relatively high. Relatively high. That doesn't necessarily pose a threat to the economy. It simply makes it more attractive for folks to hold money. In other words, the higher rates increase the demand for money, and that in turn helps to neutralize the amount of excess money supply that's still circulating. Now, while our economy, is still in an expansion mode, so far year over year, real GDP is up 2.6% year over year. We're seeing much slower growth rates in the rest of the world. The largest economy in Europe, which is Germany, has now contracted for two straight quarters, and they look like they might start to be getting out of their own way, but we'll see. Now, industrial production here in the U.S. surprised to the upside in August, up for the second month in a row, and the strength of the report was broad-based, so that's also good news. The weekly jobless claims went to 201,000 for the most recent period. That was lower than the 225,000 that they had expected. So that does suggest that the labor market remains tight. And that, again, is a challenge for the feds. So not exactly a breakthrough announcement, but not all household finances are created equal. But collectively, things are looking in a pretty decent place right now. If you want to know why the economy has, in fact, remained so resilient, you don't have to look any further than the household balance sheets that have been fixed since we had the 2008-2009 issue. The Fed has tracked household balance sheet data going back to 1952. And in each quarter, they give details on the total financial assets and liabilities for households and nonprofits. The data does not tell us where the economy is heading. But it can help us understand how we're generally positioned for whatever is going to be happening next. So as of June 30th this year, the most recent data, American households have their highest level of assets, liabilities, and net worth ever. Not just in the last couple of weeks, but ever. The latest census data is that there are 132 million households in the U.S., so you can figure that out yourself. You know, that the totals we have of all those folks, $174.4 trillion in assets, $20 trillion in liabilities, and a net worth of $154. So the good news is that households have a nice margin of safety right now. Home equity up from $19.4 trillion at the end of 2019, it's now $31 trillion. So, and mortgages make up the bulk of folks' financial debt. I was talking about the asset levels of American households, and again, it's at the highest level of assets, liabilities, and net worth ever, and that's from the Census Bureau. So about two-thirds of these dollars are in financial assets, one-third in non-financial assets. And so there's a reason that the 2008 crash was a debt crisis. People borrowed too much money. Now consider the growth of both assets and liabilities since things bottomed out back then. Since the end of the second quarter of 2009, assets have grown 136%, but liabilities are up only 40%. That's a nice difference. Assets have soared by more than $100 trillion. Debt expanded by only $5 trillion. Once again, that's very good. This means net worth has swelled by almost 160% from that point. That's pretty solid stuff. And even if we look more closely at the recent pandemic cycle, asset growth has still exceeded the growth in debt. If you look at from the end of 2019, just before the bug showed up, financial assets have climbed 31% versus a 21% rise in liabilities. So this isn't like a coming attraction of 2008. It's not even close. So don't let anybody blow smoke at you about that stuff. Now, consumers make up 70% of the economy. That's the received wisdom. I think it's pretty accurate. And most consumers are in pretty good shape, as we've just discussed, but it can't last forever without consumer credit eventually creeping higher. And the spending boom from the pandemic, somewhat artificially induced, can only last for so long. And the stock market and housing market don't go to the sky, as they say. So the gains should, level off at some point. And there's also a chance of something just coming out of the blue that throws a wrench into the whole economy. But consumers remained about as prepared as they could be for any kind of slowdown. And unless the economy shifts into another gear and overheats in the years ahead, I think our balance sheets are in pretty good place to weather any kind of mild recession. Now, about these car guys, the UAW. They went on strike last week, and they went against the big three, as they are called. That's probably a stretch in today's world, but that's what they still call them, Ford, GM, and Stellantis, a.k.a. Chrysler. And this is some of their demands. 40% increase in hourly pay over 4 years, a four-day 32-hour work week, faster path to top pay, shift back to defined benefit pensions, COLAs, and five plus weeks of vacation, more paid holidays, extended parental leave. Well, if they're going to raise pay for less hours, it seems like a bit of a stretch. And I'll tell you what, they might as well, I don't even know why they wasted their time with the defined pension thing. That's not going to happen. You know, my question, is it even possible that these three companies, such as they exist now, could remain in business if they agreed to these demands? You know, back in the 50s, there was a phrase that got a lot of traction that said, what's good for GM is good for America. And that was not a joke because of the way the economy was all oriented toward heavy industry. Well, that's not even remotely accurate in today's world. So, you know, Ford would say, in answer to my question, what would they remain in business? Ford likely would argue no, because they've lost $14 billion in the last 4 years if the UAW demands had been in place. You know, also it remains to be seen what will be agreed upon, but probably they'll get some, big pay increase, but I don't know about all this other stuff. And this begs the question, will this accelerate a move towards more automation and or a move overseas? You know, both seem likely, with the latter an immediate risk to consider for U.S. striking workers, because like Stellantis has 15,000 folks working at eight plants in Mexico, their average hourly is $2.54 an hour, and they have high productivity rates. And one group has estimated the cost of a full 10-day work stoppage at $5.6 billion, with $3.6 billion from lost wages. So, but, you know, that to us, to you and me, that's a lot of money. But taking it face value, 5.6 doesn't even make a blip on the U.S. nearly $26.8 trillion in nominal GDP. Also, there's an estimated cost of the full stoppage. That's what I was saying, that $5.6 billion is the estimated cost of a full stoppage, which would be broader than the limited action which is currently being undertaken. And under the UAW's present plan, many plants would stay open. So you know, kind of a rolling thunder thing, keeping more workers on the job and some cars and parts rolling off the assembly line. But they already had sticky issues with supply parts, as I understand it. So I doubt that the effect would even get up to that level. The longer strike would add up, but we're talking a couple tenths of a percent most shaved off GDP. And auto strikes historically tend to be short-lived anyway. As for the markets broadly, without a material big picture effect, macroeconomic, to use the $10 word, from the strikes, there's very little to suggest that a strike poses a big threat to the bull market. Markets typically, routinely, look past temporary expected events like this, just as they've seen through several other industrial actions this year in the U.S. and abroad. Now, I think the real winner in this strike may be the auto company that's been winning all along, and that's our friends at Tesla. They don't have a unionized workforce, and they've got a rapidly growing market share. Their share price is up 2,390% over the last 10 years versus a 24% increase in the same period for GM and 17% for Ford. I think the UAW is really just jousting at windmills. They're, you know, fighting to keep jobs in a business that is evolving away from them, and it's a losing battle, I'm afraid. I don't know how much they want to give up in wages and stuff before they decide it's okay to go back to work, but I guess we'll see. Now, about that government shutdown. There are some folks growing concerned that a government shutdown would cut into the fourth quarter GDP and undermine confidence in our ability to keep our own government open. Well, according to the media, this is something I don't get personally. How is it that locking down businesses was wise, but shutting down non-essential government activities is a disaster? I don't know. I guess those people apparently have no access to history reports, as those show no relationship between federal shutdowns and the performance of the economy. Okay? No relationship between Fed shutdowns and the performance of the economy. For the record, we had two government shutdowns late 95 and 96, no recession either time. There was one in 2013, no recession. There was also a brief shutdown in 2018. Guess what? No recession. This most shutdown was the longest, as in 35 days from December 2018 through Jan 2019. And yes, you guessed it, no recession. The last time a shutdown coincided with a recession was in October of 90. And that was only a four-day shutdown, but money was already tight, and the recession was kind of in the mail no matter what was happening. Here's another way to think about it. In the last 40 years, the government has been shut for 91 days. 91 days over 40 years, not a ton. And among those days, the U.S. was in recession for 4 days, and not in a recession for 87 days. So put it another way, they were in recession for 4 days over 40 years. By contrast, in the past 40 years, we've been in recession about 8% of the time. That means the economy was more likely to be growing when the federal government was shut down than when it was open. Now, I can see the wisdom of that. Doesn't mean a recession can't start in the fourth quarter. But if we do get a recession, I think it would be more a coincidence due to the lagging effects of the tighter monetary policy of the past year, and certainly not of a shutdown itself. I think, personally, inflation is, I won't say under control, but it's certainly backing down a lot. All the unusual catalysts that we had as a result of the bug and related political responses have pretty much worked their way through the system. The supply chains appear to be working well. Not too many slowdowns. So again, I don't think that inflation is going to be too much of a problem, except for what I want to talk about here, and that is, well, let me give you another quote. I started with one earlier from Mr. Buffett's mentor, Benjamin Graham. Here's one from Dr. Thomas Sowell, who is, I think, he is way past smart. But anyway, this is a quote. He said, "Inflation is a way to take people's wealth from them without having to openly raise taxes. Inflation is the most universal tax of all." Unquote. In our world, we refer to it as the hidden tax, because you'll never see it on any of your statements. But boy, howdy, you better plan for it in your long-term investing plans, or you will rue the day. So, with regard to the inflation rate, why is the overall rate going up, while it appears that the core prices are still moving down? Well, we had a jump in, August, with the fuel oil and gasoline starting to move up. And, because prior to that, the low energy prices have been a big tailwind in recent months that did help cause the CPI, Consumer Price Index, to move down to 3% in June, but less so in August. Now, core inflation, which does not include food and energy, shelter continues to be the major driver. Shelter inflation declined for the fifth straight month in August, moving down to 7.3% year over year. So this in turn should help push down core inflation. Now, Brent crude, there's two kinds of, well, there's more than that, but within the U.S. markets, there's generally two kinds of crude. There's the Brent crude, which is the global energy benchmark. It's basically the North Sea price. And then there's the West Texas price, which, strangely enough, has to do with West Texas. And so those are the U.S. prices pretty much. But Brent is like the leveler for everybody. So with that in mind, the Brent crude, which again is the benchmark, if you adjusted it for the rise in broad consumer prices since it first passed $100 a barrel back in 2008, today it stands at $64 a barrel, not the quoted $93. See, that's in other words, it's real. It's adjusted for inflation. So that's not unusual, because in this millennium, the average price in 2008 terms has been just under $62 a barrel. So it's not exactly running away. Okay, but nonetheless, oil prices still rose to a 10-month high on Tuesday. Brent went up to $95 a barrel. I think it was at 93 here yesterday. And UBS said in a note it started taking profits. Still, the UBS strategists say Brent will trade in a range of 90 to 100 per barrel over the coming months, and they've got a year-end target of 95 a barrel. And the Saudis and the Russians have extended their oil output cuts until the end of this year. And so that could result in a substantial market deficit, which is one of the reasons the oil prices are going up. The Saudis need to do it to support their society, and the Russians, who knows what they're doing it for, but because they're ornery, I guess, more than anything else. But they want to control the price. And the only way they can, not the only way, but the main way they can control the price is to curtail production and cause the demand to remain. And so with the lower supply, the prices will at least stay where they are. So inflation at this point is likely going to be primarily a function of shelter and energy costs, neither of which are predictable to any extent. So let's slide over to the market thoughts. You know, sometimes stocks and bonds move together because they have different drivers. Stocks move most on the gap between what are political and economic expectations, in other words, how those influence earnings, and reality. So what is the difference between those issues? Inflation and inflation expectations chiefly are what drive treasuries. So they largely move independently of one another. Bonds, as a class, still typically help reduce overall short-term volatility, which is the point of blended allocations. You know, that reduced swing in your overall portfolio can ease your ride through some difficult stretches. You know, just as a little mnemonic, a little something to help you remember, whenever you read or hear a scary headline, ask yourself these questions. First, are you responding to this on an emotional or a logical level? Next, how might this story look a year from now or even 10 years from now? Will it even be mentioned? And finally, how much of this quote-unquote news is already reflected in stock prices? I think your answers will probably give you some perspective, because in most cases, the news is well within the stock prices because everybody knows it, quote-unquote. Now, there's been a significant amount of talk about, with the interest rates rising from nothing to something that's a little more normal, that people should say, well, gosh, you know, I can get those predictable returns in those dang bonds, and those stocks are all over the ball yard, and it makes me crazy, and so maybe I should put a bunch of money over in the bond side. Well, let's kind of look at that for a minute. You know, first of all, when you're getting the pundits, the talking heads and so on, and they say, you know, move to bonds or buy this stock, they're talking about very, very short-term stuff. They're orienting all their commentary toward the traders, toward the institutional traders. Not you, not me, but to guys who move chunks of money around and get paid based on those results. You get paid on not making bad mistakes listening to TV guys. So anyhow, this week, the 10-year Treasury hit 4.48%. That was the highest level since 2007. Now, the media throws, highest since 2007. Oh, my goodness. Well, if you go back, we had no interest rate from 2007 till, jeepers, I don't know, 11, 12. It is still at a zero. So that isn't quite as onerous as it sounds. You know, Double Line Capital, the president, his name's Jeffrey Gundlach, he says, and I'm quoting, "I think treasury bonds are attractive, not for the long term, but more for the short term." And I think that's pretty accurate because, you know, on yesterday, the one-year U.S. Treasury bill was at 5.46%. Now, the five-year note dropped down to 4.56%. The 10-year, as we mentioned earlier, is at 4.42%. And the 30-year bond at 4.51%. So, if you're saying, hey, gosh, well, I'm not so sure where things are going over the next year or two, maybe I'll put it in some of this 5% stuff. Okay. But understand that you're kind of, I won't say Russian roulette, that's not a fair assessment, but you are making an investment choice. Because you are reacting to perhaps recency bias. You know, gee, I've seen the market's good. The stock market isn't doing well. I don't want to lose money. I'll put it in these predictable things. It'll only be for a year or more, you know. So you can say, well, I know I can get 5.4 for a year. Is that good enough? Does that meet your needs? Because what happens is that after a year, the question will become, what are you going to do with the money? Will you reinvest it there? Will it be able to be reinvested at those same levels? Stay tuned for the exciting conclusion, right? And again, you know, my biggest challenge with all this tub thumping they're doing for bonds right now is that people decide, well, gee, I can get 5.4% for a year for sure, U.S. Treasury bill. I don't know what CDs are, but are probably somewhere lower than that. But anyway, so you get 5.4% for sure. And, as long as that's good enough to meet your needs, well, maybe that's okay. But you know, you're taking a risk if you put a significant amount of your money there because you don't know what you'll be able to reinvest it at when it comes due. And, well, you know, what is the rest of the market going to do in the interim? And that's a challenge. And bonds have been doing, let's just say, not well. They are treasury notes. And, you know, talking U.S. AAA-rated good stuff, not junk. But they are headed for their third losing year in a row. And that's never happened. And there's a widely held index of government and high-grade corporate bonds. It's called the Bloomberg U.S. Aggregate Bond Index. Bloomberg U.S. Aggregate Bond Index. Again, be careful. Don't just go willy-nilly and say, well, they said on TV that things aren't good. I better be careful. Well, careful has all kinds of different meanings. And most investors repeatedly make the same dang mistake with their money. They buy high because they're greedy, and they sell low because they're afraid. And yet, this is despite knowing on an intellectual and presumably logical level that these are very bad ideas. Now, the easiest way you can study this behavior in action is to track the money flow in and out of mutual funds. And you can do that through, there's a company called Dalbar, D-A-L-B-A-R, that tracks those things. I'm sure there's other ways too, but I just know those guys for sure. And go back to early 2000. So you're talking 20 some odd years, right? But most importantly, in 2000, the dot-com market had reached a fever pitch. People were using home equity to buy tech stocks. And this was right after, in 99, now this is not a misprint, not a misspoke, but the NASDAQ had a single year return of better than 80%. That brought them in, I'll tell you what, folks. And then in January of 2000, and this according to the Investment Company Institute, that's they track all the mutual fund business. Investors then put $44 billion into stock mutual funds of all types. We know that the story was from there because money continued to pour into stock funds, and those were especially the tech-oriented ones. And they broke records for deposits in Feb and March and pushed the NASDAQ up to 5,000. Well, that was before it lost half its value by October of 2002. Now, there was reasons for that, okay? I mean, there's the whole dot-com thing and what have you, but that's a pretty significant drop. And most folks wrote them down, and it gets worse. That same October, which was the low for the cycle, investors selling stocks as fast as they could. What were they doing with the money? Well, of course, they put it into bond funds at a time when bond prices were near record highs. That's not the way to do it. At the top of the market, they can't buy fast enough. And then about 3 years later, at the bottom, they can't sell fast enough. And they repeat the behavior over and over and over until, let's just say, their asset base has been severely diminished. You know, no wonder most people are unsatisfied with their investments. And especially, dare I say, the self-directed folks. The bearish case is always more compelling and more articulate, while the bullish argument is usually about the future and the unknown. You know, you can always, the perm bears, as they're called, can always make a what sounds like a very logical, telling, convincing argument for why the world is going to end right after our commercial. But those of us who are on the more positive side of the equation, I can't tell you exactly when or how things are going to break out, but I got history on my side, and I've also got the numbers on my side, so I'm not too worried about it. So, in any regard, you know, can you imagine, now think about it, have you ever logically considered, okay, I'm going to sell now because it's down, I just want to get out, it hurts too much to stay with it, okay. Or, on the other hand, I just want to buy it because I really want to buy it. What if you went into your friendly Mercedes dealer or favorite vehicle of choice and said, I need a new vehicle? And our friendly salesperson, being always willing to help, says, "You're in luck. We just marked them up by 30%. And you turn around and say, "I'll take three." Okay, that's not all that far-fetched, unfortunately. So, you know, people are hardwired to look for more of what creates security and pleasure and run away fast from things that cause pain. I mean, you learn that in behavioral psychology 101. You mix that with your desire to be following the herd because you feel there's safety in numbers. Once again, this is the deadly conventional wisdom that we like to rail against. And you get a pretty potent cocktail. Not necessarily positive, but it's definitely going to, you know, the peer pressure is all over the place. And when everyone else is buying, it feels as if you don't join them, you're going to get eaten by the saber-toothed tiger Wall Street version. So while you may not be able to totally overcome your fear, okay, you need to do whatever you can to not act on that fear. Train yourself to not act on your fear and greed with your investments. Because you see, not losing money can be very costly. Everybody hates losing money. So being able to say, "Well, at least I didn't lose any money," feels great when the market falls. And no, not too terrible when the market goes up. But when it comes to big decisions about money, you should also be including your financial goals. Remember, like I said a minute ago, is that 5.4% for a year the number you need to help you meet your overall goals with your asset allocation plan? I don't know. I mean, everybody's got a little different way of coming at it. See, for most people, the stock market is where you seek to accumulate your long-term wealth. How you save for your retirement or your college tuition, or maybe how you even plan on paying for a dream house in 20 years or less. The catch is, in order to achieve most of those major financial goals, you have to actually be in the market. Not talking about it, not observing it, but in it, and willing to deal with the regular short-term price moves. And while it's great not to lose money when the market's down, it can be incredibly costly for you to be out of the market when the prices are going up. And, as I said earlier, history's on my side, and with the market historically being up 80% of the time over time, then time in the market matters. I certainly appreciate you listening. I hope you found this helpful and interesting. I won't be here next week, but I believe my partner Jim Harvey will be holding forth, and he has a lot of good things to say. So have a positive, enlightening week. I hope it's productive. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week. This is Money Management, powered by the Opus 111 Group. Thank you.
Join us again next Saturday morning at this same time for the financial insight, opinion, and perspective of Money Management with Opus 111's Mike Nail. Have a question or comment? Email us at info@opus111group.com or visit our website, opus111group.com. Sections of this radio show contain forward-looking statements that are not guarantees of future performance. This information is from sources we believe to be reliable. However, we cannot guarantee that it is accurate or complete. These comments are for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, nor as a recommendation to buy or sell any security or investment product mentioned in this show. Investing involves risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Individual circumstances do vary. Please consult an investment professional prior to making any investment decisions.